into gold coins, and the reason for that was clearly visible in the string of lingering messages inside the mimic's mind. Proficiency level increased. Hornet style is now level 4. Strength plus 2. Agility plus 2. Proficiency level increased. Puppet parasite is now level 4. Intelligence plus 2. Charisma plus 2. Proficiency level increased. Adagio variation is now level 3. Dexterity plus 2. Agility plus 2. Chaotic energies swirl around you. The next thing you kill will explode into a shower of gold. Proficiency level increased. Winter Lich Waltz is now level 2. Agility plus 2. Intelligence plus 2. Level up. Congratulations, you are now a level 16 Blade Dancer. Dexterity plus 2. Endurance plus 2. Strength plus 1. Agility plus 1. Proficiency level increased. Winter Lich Waltz is now level 3. Agility plus 2. Intelligence plus 2. The shapeshifter let out a laugh of one clearly drunk on power. Its newly acquired job and related skills were developing at a mind-boggling pace. How long had it been since Boxy experienced rapid growth like this? It was so delicious that it almost forgot itself. The monster reined in its enthusiasm. It had to be careful not to be found out, even if there was a million-to-one chance someone from the fort might see it like this. Well, getting 16 levels of a new job within 4 days would probably turn quite a few heads, but its next guild-mandated full appraisal wasn't for another 2 months. It would be quite some time before it was in any real danger of someone questioning Kira's abnormal level progression, but that moment would surely come. Even if essence concealment had a way of toning down the apparent level of general skills, jobs were far more binary. They and their related skills could be either shown or hidden, and that was it. This was an odd distinction, but that was just how things were. At the very least, it wouldn't have to explain how it obtained such a high level of sword mastery in so little time. Honestly speaking, though, being able to completely hide the fact it was a doppelganger was all the shapeshifter really wanted out of the skill. Everything else was an added bonus so long as it had access to job trainers. Indeed, having a proper job to support its swordplay really made a huge amount of difference. The hornet-style skill it learned as a level 5 blade dancer gave it the ability to use the same bizarre yet effective one-handed fighting style Jessie had demonstrated during her spar. Adagio variation, on the other hand, was less like a stance, as Hilda had described it, and more of a physical boost that assisted Kira's movements. And last but not least, there was Winter Lich Waltz. It was an odd skill, halfway between a spell and a martial art. It evoked caster-like magical effects through continuous motion rather than chanting. Unlike Jessie, however, Kira had enough intelligence to make the ability quite devastating. Of course, the creature hadn't neglected its monster skills either. Using puppet parasite in humanoid form was a bit tricky, but the monster forced itself to learn how to do it. It would be fighting a lot more in Kira's body, and needed to practice employing its various abilities with speed and subtlety. That and many blade dancer skills required a more standard arrangement of limbs. Winter Lich Waltz, for instance, was impossible to use unless one had exactly 2 feet and 2 arms. Even Hornet style was tricky to use properly with tentacles, but the passive boost it gave to sword damage was quite tasty all the same. That said, the boon couldn't compare to Boxy having its chaotic disposition actually produce a favorable result for once. The shapeshifter half expected the coins it had produced to fade away with time. It wasn't as if the knoll turned into gold, but more like the coins burst out of its skull as if they had always been there. Meaning they were likely conjured out of thin air and would disappear into nothingness with time. Even if that weren't the case, there was no merchant out there that would consider them legal tender. In fact, it was more accurate to call these things chips than coins. Each was blank on both sides, lacking the crests or portraits of dead guys that governments typically carved into minted currency. The relative size and weight would put each chip's value somewhere around 18 gold pieces, but no such denomination existed in either the Empire or the Republic. Or anywhere else, for that matter. Most nations on the continent of Attica complied with a series of ancient regulations known collectively as the Gold Standard Concordat. These had been put in place over a millennium ago by Mortimer, the god of death and commerce, presumably as a means of ensuring profitable trade between the various enlightened cultures. As a result, the various nations used functionally identical currency. A king peace coin, for instance, had the same weight, composition, dimensions, and monetary worth of 50 GP regardless of which nation minted it. There was nothing keeping merchants and shopkeepers from accepting foreign currency other than their political views and beliefs. It was therefore highly unlikely anyone would accept the freshly conjured almost coins Boxy gleefully stuffed into its storage, but the shapeshifter didn't care. It actually preferred them over real money, since the perfectly flat and smooth edges made the blank coins that much shinier. It understood they'd likely disappear, but Boxy wouldn't be Boxy if it let such curious shinies wallow in the dirt unappreciated. There was still joy to be found in the acts of picking them up, carefully cleaning them, and safely depositing them in its pocket dimension one by one. If nothing else, this was a much more enjoyable instance of chaotic disposition than the one that had triggered during its first assault on the knolls. Being suddenly transported 20 meters in a random direction was something it had experienced a few times before, but getting teleported 20 kilometers? It shuddered to think what would have happened if the spot it appeared in was straight up in the air, or deep underground. It had been inwardly cursing Jedediah, the goddess of chaos, for forcing this infuriating ability onto it, but this literal jackpot had somewhat improved Boxy's opinion of chaotic disposition. Having finished collecting the temporary boon to its ever-growing hoard, the shapeshifter reverted to its favorite chest-bound shape and proceeded to eat up the gnoll's remnants. Unlike before, it could leisurely savor the flavor, so it was in no rush to scarf them down. Their flesh was a bit stringy, but definitely on the tasty side. The frozen ones were even better than normal, as their iced-over flesh and bone was really crunchy and fun to chew on. Stuffing so many icy bits into its maw so quickly proved to be a bad decision, when Boxy suddenly felt a shooting pain run up the back of its throat and spread across the top of its lid. Its immediate thought was that it had eaten a poisoned gnoll again, but a quick consultation with Snack revealed this was not the case. Apparently, the creature had just experienced something called a brain freeze. Boxy immediately began to panic, but its faithful familiar was quick to assure her master that the term was very much metaphorical. All of that settled, the criminally ignorant shapeshifter thought on its next course of action.
"Now then, I should probably head back."
This pack of gnolls was the last one in the area, and the length of Kira's solo hunting trips were starting to push the boundaries of what was acceptable within the Republic's armed forces during times of war. Pretty soon she would get almost no free time, which was partly why Boxy was so adamant about getting as many levels as possible within a short time frame. At the very least, its educated guess was spot on, and the vast majority of the XP it got from killing things with swords went towards its blade dancer job. This would definitely need to be the very last occupation Boxy picked up in the foreseeable future. It was common knowledge among adventurers that an individual with one job at level 100 was infinitely more terrifying than someone who had 5 at level 20, and Boxy was already splitting its focus too much. The shapeshifter was a warlock while spell-slinging, an artificer while tinkering, a blade dancer while swinging a sword around, a ranger while shooting at things with a bow, and a doppelganger at all times. Oh, right, its ranger job had hit level 30 along the way. Boxy was so enthralled with killing things, it almost forgot about it. Now that it was free from Fayhorn's nagging, it could freely pick the skills it wanted, and it almost immediately chose one it heard much about. Hunter's Mark. A good hunter never loses sight of their quarry. Requirements: level 30 ranger, 200 perception. Type: active. Activation time: instant. Cost: 130 MP. Range: 200 meters. Effects: tracks the target's location for the next 30 minutes. Targets afflicted with Hunter's Mark take additional damage from projectile-based weaponry equal to 2% per level of this skill. Increases the range and duration of this skill by 20% per level of this skill. It was a skill that could be called the natural enemy of rogues, spies, and any other job that relied on stealth or invisibility. An unwitting target could get tagged at a distance without realizing it, at which point the ranger could tell their exact location regardless of how sneaky they were. Even if they realized they were marked by tracking magic, they'd need a wizard's D-spell or a paladin or priest to cleanse them of the effect. The extra potency of ranged attacks was nothing to scoff at either. Lastly, the skill would certainly prove useful once Boxy grew strong enough to seek vengeance on Edward, making this a no-brainer. Proficiency level increased. Hunter's mark is now level 1. Intelligence plus 2. Wisdom plus 2. Perception plus 2. That said, Boxy already had a more immediate use for it in mind. Underwood's intelligence gathering had determined that no less than 6 Imperials with level 100 jobs would be present at the upcoming siege. Hunter's mark would make it easier for the shapeshifter to track and avoid these VIPs. Boxy had serious doubts it could survive any of them, even if it didn't have to maintain its cover as Kira. Reaching level 100 in a job did more than allow Enlightened to rank up. It gave them access to a unique and extremely powerful ultimate skill. Fayhorn's was something called Turret Stance, which allowed him to fire arrows with a truly unbelievable rate of fire so long as he stood still. Hilda's ultimate was Tempest of Wrath, which unleashed her inner rage to bolster allies while hindering enemies. Boxy didn't know the exact effects and conditions of either skill, but that was expected. The only reason the ex-mimic knew about those two was because it had gotten close to them as Kira, but adventurers normally kept the details about their trump cards as secret as possible. It wasn't far-fetched to say the tide of a battle between two armies could easily sway depending on how effectively each side utilized the ultimate skills at their disposal. In a situation where the Empire fielded 6 such people while the Republic only had 3, the latter would almost always lose. This would be the case even if the defenders had a large advantage in troop strength, which they most certainly didn't. In short, the Republic's defeat was more or less a certainty. Even knowing that, simply giving up Fort Yemen and the surrounding region without a fight was even worse in the long run. The elves had no choice but to make a stand. They were in a desperate situation, and if Boxy learned anything from its days at the Mercenary Guild in Erosa, it was that desperate people made for excellent clients. Hence why Mr. Sandman had offered the Third Legion's leadership a plan that just might tip the scales in their favor. It didn't really care whether they won or lost. It just wanted to secure as much profit as possible. Fort Yemen's commanding officers naturally frowned at the vigilante's profiteering behavior, but they ultimately accepted the deal. In fact, it was just about time for Boxy to collect its down payment, so it wasted no time getting back to base. A quick cast of transfamiliar caused it to swap places with Claws, who was about 60 kilometers away. This distance was around the limit of Boxy's current MP. Transfamiliar, like other spatial relocation magic, grew in cost directly proportional to the distance traveled. In other words, as long as Boxy's MP grew, so too would the distance it could cover in a single use of the spell. Right now, however, it was still several kilometers away from Fort Yemen, inside a secluded cave covered in Claws webs. It quickly assumed Kira's form and took her gear out of storage. It could have worn it during the Knoll hunt, but that would have left some very conspicuous stains and holes in her outfit. Not the sort of condition one would expect it to be in after what was supposed to be a light hunt. Once Kira was properly dressed, she strode out of the cave and ran on all fours back to the fort. She returned to the base in the early afternoon and was almost immediately sent out again. The redhead was escorted by the same platoon of soldiers as last time, including another chest heavy with treasure. A gnomish wizard, one of Imiril's disciples, handled the gate spell that transported the group from the outskirts of the fort to the vicinity of Cirilla's tree. This time, the armed soldiers let Kira carry the heavy chest to the dryad's resting spot all by herself, right from the start. Although the embarrassment this particular bunch suffered at her hands was not made public, none of them were keen to repeat it. Imiril herself had suffered the worst of it, so none were surprised to hear she refused to ever get near that tree again. There was also the matter that news of her spanking had somehow spread throughout the fort, and many believed the outlandish tale. The infamously snobbish High Elf showed far too much modesty and reservation as of late for that scandalous rumor to not be true. That aside, the Beastkin's escorts couldn't help but feel their mission had changed. Since the Sandman had apparently proven himself trustworthy, the purpose of their presence was most likely to ensure a third party didn't show up and ruin the transaction. So, the Rangers and the platoon focused their attention on the surrounding planes, and only one of them watched the Beastkin carry the payment of 5,000 GP off to the tree. She wobbled unsteadily for the latter half of the short walk due to the sheer weight of the gold in that chest, but she made it to the base of the ancient tree without incident. Just like before, a cloaked figure they could only assume was the Sandman dropped down from above. He checked on the contents of the chest, and then handed something small to Kira, which she immediately stowed in a pouch on her belt. She then took out the beautiful mithril rapier on her waist, gave it a few demonstrative swishes, and bowed to the Sandman, presumably in thanks. Leaving the chest behind, she walked back to the rest of the platoon, at which point the wizard took them all back to base. All things said and done, the whole transaction had taken no more than 10 minutes. Once they were back at the fort, Kira immediately reported to Underwood's stuffy office, as the man had become her direct superior at this point. Technically, he was her boss's boss, but Fayhorn was still away on some assignment or another, and as such was incapable of relaying orders down the chain of command. Boxy considered whether this timing was intentional, but it didn't care too much since it got paid regardless.
"Ah, Decanus,"
Silas greeted Kira as she entered his office.
"Shall I take your speedy return as a sign that things went smoothly?"
"Yes, sir. No incidents whatsoever,"
she happily saluted.
"That's good. So, do you have the item?"
"Yeah. Should I show it to you here and now?"
"Indeed. Let's see it."
The Beastkin reached into the pouch on her belt and brought out a small orb that was 7 or 8 centimeters in diameter. It was made of deep orange amber with a high degree of transparency and a flawlessly smooth surface. A single blue flower with 7 large petals was trapped inside the resin, as if it were suspended in time.
"Oh my, it's quite something, isn't it?"
stated the elf in admiration. If this was truly what the Sandman had promised during their earlier communications, then the Republic had a very real chance at victory in the upcoming siege. If not, then they had been duped out of a small fortune. This was something he and his superiors judged was a worthwhile risk, despite the fact that the idea the masked man presented them with sounded outlandish and ludicrous at best. Silas personally felt like they were grasping at straws, but he still pushed his superiors to accept the Sandman's deal. Both his job and his life were on the line, so he was rather pleased that this amber orb at least looked like the sort of precious treasure the masked man had claimed to possess.
"Yes, sir. It's really pretty."
Kira's simplistic statement accompanied a blooming smile that seemed determined to outshine the item in her hands. If Underwood was a betting man, he'd put his money on the cat girl's beautiful face winning that competition.
"Wait, why am I comparing the two?"
The elf let a small frown float onto his lips as he silently chastised himself. This was no time to admire his subordinate's natural charm. Besides, he knew better than to try anything. Pursuing a personal relationship with her was a bad idea for so many reasons that he'd probably need a third hand to count them all.
"And how exactly do we use it?"
he asked after that brief moment of self-reflection.
"Ah, that's easy. Mr. Sandman told me you just need hold on to it and say in a clear and commanding voice, 'Mater est opus vobis.'"
"Wait, don't just—"
Silas tried to stop her, but it was too late. The orb in the cat girl's hands flashed with an intense yellow light before Underwood could stop her. The radiance temporarily blinded the elf and caused the cat girl to scream in a high-pitched wail. It took nearly 20 seconds for Underwood's vision to begin to recover, and he could clearly hear Kira's pained screams and panicked thrashing the whole time. It sounded like the redhead had fallen out of her seat and was rolling around on the floor in agony. That was only to be expected, considering her much sharper eyesight was far more vulnerable to this sort of sensory overload. The man's vision was still blurry and full of spots when a couple of soldiers barged into the room, no doubt to see what all the commotion was about.
"Sir, are you all right?"
one of them asked.
"I'll be fine," Underwood shouted while rubbing his eyes. "Take the girl to the infirmary, quickly."
This sort of magical flare could permanently damage someone's eyesight, and Fayhorn would have his head if he came back to find his star pupil in less than pristine condition.
"Sir, I believe that would be a very bad idea."
"What are you talking about? Get moving before... before... oh."
As his eyes slowly readjusted themselves, he could make out Kira's figure. She was curled up on the floor and holding onto her face with both hands, just as he'd expected. However, his previously impaired vision prevented him from noticing when, where, or how, but it would appear the two of them had some unexpected company. Underwood beheld the form of a small girl, seemingly no more than 9 or 10 years old. She had green skin, grass-like hair, and wore nothing but a cluster of giant leaves that draped over her like a summer dress. Even though she looked so young, the two soldiers were clearly fearful of her. Both of them were a part of Kira's escort unit and had been waiting for their own debriefing, so they were very aware of just how terrifying this seemingly innocent creature could be. Silas, as their commanding officer, immediately caught on as well. The child was a dryad, and she wasn't the only one. At first, the elf thought his messed up vision was playing tricks on him, but now he was certain that there were, in fact, 5 of them. 5 identical-looking immature dryads, presumably one for each of the hilt trees that made up the cornerstones of Fort Yemen's defensive line. Yet, none of them seemed to care about or even notice any of the people in the room. The only exception to this was the writhing cat girl on the ground. The many dryads huddled around her and stared at her suffering in total silence. Their identical faces sported the same expression of childlike wonder and curiosity. This went on for several seconds, until Kira's screaming and thrashing began to abate, at which point the 5 crouched down to get a better look at her. When the cat girl finally opened her eyes, she was greeted with the sight of 5 identical green faces looking down at her with some sort of unspoken expectation. Not sure of what to do, the redhead forced a weak smile and spoke in a quiet, quivering voice.
Hello?
The quintet of juvenile dryads smiled in response and spoke up in a single, unified voice.
Mommy!
Part 5. Kira found herself in a decidedly odd situation. She sat in a large conference room she hadn't been in before. 5 people were on the opposite end of an oval table in front of her, and 5 more stood around her in a circle. All 10 pairs of eyes were on her. She officially knew only 2 of those on the opposite side of the room. They were her direct superiors, Silas Underwood and Milo Fayhorn. The latter of them had returned from his assignment barely half an hour ago. Next to them was an older elf with slicked back black hair and the fanciest uniform. He was Legate Aiden, the officer that stood at the head of the Republic's 3rd Legion. Immediately to his right was a green-haired man who was extremely lanky and thin, even by elf standards. This fellow was named Dranor, and he served as the Legate's right-hand man, advisor, and strategist. The last elf was a middle-aged woman who would look almost exactly like a younger Imiril if not for her light, ginger hair that had been put up in a tidy ponytail. She was Prefect Vera, the High Elf's niece and the officer in charge of Fort Yemen and the surrounding area. Even if Kira hadn't been formally introduced to the latter 3, Boxy still knew about them since it had talked to all of them remotely as the Sandman. The comm crystal it had given Underwood was actually laid out in the middle of the table should the reclusive vigilante contact them again. This was quite unlikely to happen at that time, much to the dismay of the elves gathered there. They urgently needed to speak with the Sandman about two pressing matters. The first was the item they had purchased from him earlier that day. The second, and arguably more pressing issue, had to do with the five juvenile dryads that surrounded the young Decanus Morgana at the other end of the room.
Mummy, Mummy, how come you have those funny-looking leaves?
One asked while tugging on the beastkin's feline ears.
Mummy, how do you make saplings if you don't have flowers?
Inquired another who sat in her lap.
Mom, Terenia keeps hogging all the morning sunlight,
complained a third, tugging on her right arm.
I can't help it if I just grew on that side of you.
The culprit in question stomped her feet indignantly.
Mummy, it itches,
whined the last one while pulling on Kira's other arm with a pleading face. The elven leaders shared some difficult looks as the noisy disturbance didn't seem like it would end any time soon.
Well, at least we know the item worked as promised,
said Dranor the strategist, his voice oozing with sarcasm.
This is a dream, right? Yes, a dream. That's what this is.
Vera buried her face in her palms.
Calm yourself, Prefect,
Underwood reprimanded.
You're being unsightly in front of our guests.
What guests?
The woman snapped.
They've been here far before any of us have, right? If anyone here is a guest, it's us.
Well, you're not wrong,
Silas answered wearily.
Primus Underwood is correct.
The legate took charge.
This is no time to panic. We have to assess and adapt to the situation.
Vera seemed to calm down a bit at those words, though Aiden's slightly quivering voice showed he wasn't completely undisturbed by this turn of events either.
Continue your report, Primus.
Yes, sir,
responded Underwood with a respectful nod of his head.
So, after Decanus Morgana accidentally triggered the authority, the dryads you now see appeared in my office. They've been following her around incessantly since.
This seems a bit wrong, though, Fayhorn chimed in. The veteran ranger had been made aware of the situation through comm crystals while he was out on his mission, so he knew the gist of what had been going on in his absence. He fully understood the circumstances after Underwood finished bringing everyone up to speed just now, not to mention seeing the dryads with his very eyes.
What do you mean, wrong?
Asked Dranor.
The authority called out the dryads and made them respect the user, just like the Sandman said it would.
The Elder Dryad's authority was the name of the amber orb the elves had received from the masked vigilante. It was something that Ambrosia had personally prepared for Boxy when she found out her new tenant would be headed further south and might come in contact with her daughters. Strictly speaking, it was highly unlikely they would be her direct offspring, as the seeds that spawned them could have come from any hilt tree. Such details didn't seem to matter much to her kind, however. All dryads could trace their lineage back to Azure Vale's original 12, so each one would instantly recognize Ambrosia or one of her peers as their mother without a second thought. Of course, that didn't mean they would actually meet in person. A dryad's way of life meant it was likely impossible for them to meet others of their kind, unless they happened to grow up in close proximity to one another. However, that instinctual parental recognition was exactly why the authority was so potent. Simply put, the amber orb was a vessel containing Ambrosia's highly condensed mana, her essence, or scent. This stored energy could be released in a single burst by anyone who spoke the words, Mater est opus vobis, which, loosely translated from the divine tongue to, Mother has need of you, while holding on to the orb. This would, in turn, summon all the dryads in the area to the orb, and they would instinctively regard the item's bearer as a messenger from their mother and treat them favorably. Indeed, that was how the Sandman and Cirilla first met, and the situation in that meeting room proved the masked stranger was not talking out of his ass when he explained the item's function. Boxy had, of course, omitted certain incriminating details and specifics, but it had otherwise been entirely truthful.
Well, Fayhorn scratched his chin. Accidental activation aside, their behavior is a lot more extreme than favorable treatment. They completely think of the girl as their actual mum, don't they?
He has a point,
Vera weakly agreed.
And how come they're all little kids?
Good question, nodded Legate Aiden. Well, Decanus, anything you can tell us about all this?
Me? Why are you asking me?
Kira responded in a shrill voice, then remembered her place.
I mean, sir.
If not you, then who?
Well, I can't...
She glanced at the five immature tree spirits around her, but stopped herself from suggesting something painfully obvious and stupidly redundant. The committee had already tried questioning them directly numerous times, but the five dryads ignored them and their questions completely. It was as if Kira was the only person whose existence was worth acknowledging. They were quite arrogant for a bunch of brats, to be sure.
Why don't you try asking them for yourself, Miss Morgana? Fayhorn suggested.
Oh, of course. How should I even call them?
She mumbled quietly while the five green children pestered her.
Ahem. Kids?
Yes, Mummy?
All of them stopped what they were doing and responded in total unison with the exact same innocent smile on their faces.
Why do you think I'm your mummy?
The redhead asked.
You smell like our mummy, therefore you are mummy.
Again, their voices rang out in perfect sync, accompanied by simultaneous head nods.
Smell?
Yep, it's the same smell as the fancy light that woke us up.
The truth had to do with their species' millennia-long life cycle, which meant their kind matured incredibly slowly compared to other living creatures. They also spent the vast majority of their childhood sleeping, blissfully unaware of the world around them. Many never even bothered to wake up, unless some grave threat or major disturbance befell their trees. If one considered this fact, then it was extremely likely that this was the first time this bunch was actually awake. Not knowing any better, the dryads had assumed that the being bathed in that motherly essence was a mother-like existence to them. Unfortunately, Boxy knew nothing about any of this. It would need to have a long chat with Ambrosia on the subject later, but for now it was just as befuddled as the rest of the room.
Good enough, I suppose, said Aiden. Decanus, leave the room and wait outside until further notice.
Yes, sir.
The cat girl stood up with a salute and left the room, with her chattering entourage in tow. Their high-pitched voices could still be heard faintly through the thick door, but the room was significantly quieter than before. The legate was the first one to break the newly descended, almost silence.
So, Fayhorn, in your opinion, do you think she can control those dryads?
I wouldn't know, sir, the ranger responded honestly. Morgana seems to have a handle on things for the moment. But control? You'd have to consult someone else. This really isn't my area of expertise. Maybe Imeril has some insights on this?
That's going to be difficult, sir,
Underwood butted in.
She had an unfortunate altercation with the dryad that shelters the Sandman, so she adamantly refuses to be anywhere near one of their kind, let alone five.
An altercation, you say? I didn't hear anything about that.
Silas briefly explained the details surrounding that event, including the humiliating spanking she had received in front of the troops. This news surprised the ranger. Taking down a powerful VIP and an entire armed and alert platoon of soldiers in a matter of seconds was quite the feat, to say the least. The Sandman had, during their last communication, claimed that Cirilla hadn't even broken a sweat, so to speak. The stranger had used the incident as an example of just how terrifying a dryad could be to people. From there, he suggested that the elves might want to mobilize the tree spirits that lived in their precious fort, which led to him letting the Republic borrow the Elder Dryad's authority for a nominal fee.
I see. So, that's what this meeting is really about. The ranger nodded slowly. You're trying to formulate a defense plan? Not picking on the rookie for making a blunder?
As expected, you catch on quick, sir.
Underwood offered a wry smile. The idea was rather straightforward. Lure the enemy force inside the fort's walls and use the Dryad's power to subdue them en masse. Once immobilized and secured, the elves could do whatever they wanted with them. Still, even if they pulled it off, there were bound to be those that escaped the trap. Fayhorn's experience told him those restraints were not as all-powerful as they would appear at first glance. While it was true that Imiril got taken down without being able to put up a fight, that was mostly because she was ill-suited for that sort of situation. A wizard, however mighty, was no different from a civilian once their MP ran out. An absurdly muscle-headed existence like Hilda, on the other hand, would likely be able to rip, tear, and chop her way out of those roots and vines with brute strength. The ranger himself was certain he could avoid being caught with his superior speed and reflexes, even if the plants took him by surprise. In short, the defenders would have to remain vigilant even in the event that this plan worked. It was questionable how dependable this idea actually was, but it was a real chance at an actual victory the elves wouldn't have otherwise.
"I guess I can't fault you people for taking that chance," Fayhorn commented.
"Well, it was hardly the easiest decision to make,"
the strategist shook his head.
"Honestly, I don't like it one bit. There are far too many unknowns regarding Primus Underwood's contact. And I don't like unknowns. Also—
"We've already discussed this at length, Drenor,"
the legate cut him off.
"Like it or not, we agreed that the potential benefits were well worth the risk."
"The potential benefits being the ongoing existence of this fort, I'm guessing,"
Vera chimed in.
"Your sarcasm is noted, Prefect,"
Aiden curtly responded.
"In any event, we may be off to a rough start, but the item seems to have worked perfectly. What became of it after the Decanus misfired it?"
"The answer is right in front of you, sir,"
reported Underwood while gesturing at the brown, muddled orb on the table.
"What you see there is the object, but it no longer holds any of the radiant luster it had when I first saw it. We'll confirm it later to be sure, but even I can tell it's more or less lost its power."
That wouldn't be permanent, though. In truth, it just needed a week or so to recharge itself. But that wasn't something the elves needed to know. Nor would they have the time to wait that long, as the Imperial invasion was expected to arrive within the next 3 or 4 days. Fayhorn and his teams spent most of the last week trying to slow them down, but they were unable to do much damage to a 30,000-strong army. The 1st Scouting Battalion had already effectively blown their load with that landslide ambush on the 1st Expeditionary Force. While it was a huge success, it meant the Republic had shown the Empire their hand. As a direct result, the main force was much more thorough and careful in their approach, leaving little room for the elves to pull any tricks. Harassing the Empire's scouts in small skirmishes was pretty much all the Republic soldiers could do.
"I see. That is most unfortunate,"
the legate said grimly.
"Regardless of the complications,"
he glared at Kira's empty seat,
"we still have a hard battle ahead of us. Is there any chance of Operation Honeytrap succeeding at this point?"
He looked around the table, silently asking for the others' input.
"I'm of the opinion I'd much rather rely on our soldiers than these dryads,"
noted the strategist.
"While our defeat is almost certain, it is our duty to inflict as much damage to these invaders as we can. Otherwise, they'll regroup and move on to our next stronghold further north. Allowing those things to run wild could jeopardize not only this fort, but the entire region."
It was a cold, calculated argument meant to minimize the overall damage to the Ishigar Republic. Losing Fort Yemen would be painful, but it was better than giving up the rich Mithril mine that lay deeper in Republic territory.
"I disagree, sir,"
Underwood spoke up.
"I think we should give Decanus Morgana a chance to make up for her blunder."
"Are you certain it was an honest mistake?"
Aiden asked pointedly.
"I'm sure of it, sir. She hadn't been briefed on what the item or its function were, nor would my contact have had reason to inform her of those details."
"You are confident she can be trusted?"
"Yes, sir.
I've investigated her background, personal relationships, and personality as much as I could in this short amount of time. While she may not hold genuine loyalty to the Republic itself, her motivation to protect those closest to her is genuine. Not to mention, she has reason enough to bear a heavy grudge towards the Empire, and would not let them do as they please.
So what? She's trustworthy because she's the enemy of our enemy?
Vera raised an eyebrow. Something like that, ma'am. Silas personally disagreed with that old adage. In his opinion, the enemy of his enemy was his enemy's enemy, nothing more, nothing less. However, this was neither the right time nor place to argue semantics or philosophy.
Will the Dryads follow her instructions?
Dranor asked the important question.
Just because they have a favorable impression of her doesn't mean they'll just blindly obey.
I wouldn't suggest we involve her if I thought she was incapable of doing so, sir.
Those words seemed enough to convince the pessimistic strategist. Silas Underwood was an expert at handling personnel and sniffing out people's true intentions. That was why he had been appointed as the one responsible for the highly individualistic adventurers in the first place. If he insisted Kira could be trusted, then the others had no reason to doubt his judgment.
How do we know they're capable of doing the same as this other one down south?
Vera pointed out.
Appearances aside, they themselves said they just woke up, right? Would they even know how to use their abilities?
Oh, we can easily ascertain their ability. Fayhorn leaned back in his chair. The real problem is making them understand friend from foe, and motivating them to act on our behalf. That's exactly why I said we should give up on them, chimed in the strategist. They don't just look like children. They completely act the part. They're far too innocent.
I suppose there is that, too, the ranger scowled.
What do you mean? Was this not what you were talking about?
Dranor raised an eyebrow.
There is no such thing as an innocent monster, Dranor. And make no mistake, that is exactly what those creatures are. Unless we properly motivate them, they will not lift a single finger for our sake, even if their mother told them to do it.
The room fell silent as everyone mulled over the ranger's words. They carried the weight of over 60 years of adventuring experience, and the passion of a man who truly loved his country and its people.
I think, Legate Aiden spoke up after a brief pause, there is merit to using those dryads. However, I would like to speak to the one most concerned before making a decision.
Should I fetch the Decanus, sir?
Please do, Primus.
Underwood stood up with a salute and went out of the room for a moment. It wasn't until he opened the door that the elven leaders realized the chattering of the quintuplets had died down at some point. The cause became apparent when the beastkin returned, carrying a sleeping dryad on each arm, while the other three trailed behind with drowsy steps. When she sat back in her seat, they all lay down at her feet and fell asleep while she looked over them with a mix of patience and concern. Nobody could say a thing. Regardless of the circumstances, she looked exactly like a mother tending to her young. Motherhood was an almost sacred thing in elven culture, so they couldn't just thoughtlessly interrupt.
Sir?
It wasn't until Kira spoke up that the legate snapped out of the stupor.
Ah, yes. It seems you have reached some sort of understanding with these children.
I suppose you could say that, sir.
I see.
Judging from how they slumbered undisturbed despite the conversation, it was probably safe to keep talking. Still, the elves subconsciously lowered their voices. All of them looked perfectly serene and at peace, and having the slightly smiling beastkin look over them painted a rather uniquely precious scene.
I didn't ask for this!
Inside Kira's head, however, Boxy was fuming.
These damned plants! Why do they have to make so many demands? Always with the mommy this and mommy that. Ah! Why the crap did I activate the shiny ball like that? Stupid! Stupid, 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 stupid!
This time around, the shapeshifter truly had nobody to blame but itself. It had gotten a bunch of levels during its recent gnoll hunt and had also found a new and surprisingly tasty way to enjoy its food. It then got paid and would likely receive even more money in the future if things went well. With its head so full of shiny thoughts, it completely zoned out and triggered the Elder Dryad's authority by accident. Its original plan was to have someone else handle the matter while Kira sat on the sidelines. The shapeshifter feared that its persona would attract the wrong kind of attention if it continued to be publicly involved with the matter. That and Boxy seriously did not want to deal with any more dryads. At least Cirilla was smart enough to recognize the creature wasn't her real mother. Their arrangement was temporary, an understanding of sorts. She would help the Sandman, and in return the Sandman's minions would help her with any miscellaneous requests. It was a simple, straightforward, and non-intrusive agreement. That was well and good, but Boxy still wanted to avoid having to make deals with any more of her kind, if at all possible. And yet here it was, saddled with five damnable, selfish brats that would not shut up.
Ah, this isn't like me. I need to calm down.
Boxy realized its temper had been flaring up a bit too often as of late. Though it once had near-infinite patience as a simple mimic, its transformation into a doppelganger seemed to have shortened its fuse significantly. It couldn't help but wonder, were all doppelgangers like this? Or maybe the way it kept forcing itself to be so expressive all the time had some sort of feedback that affected its normally cool and collected state of mind. Whatever the cause, it was definitely a problem. If it hadn't been so excited during the handoff earlier, then it wouldn't have gotten itself in this mess to begin with. Hypothetical situations aside, the reality of the matter was that it was far too deep in this to just back out now, and it needed to make the most of it. At the very least, the dryads would be physically unable to follow once it left this place behind. Even if they tried, they would have no choice but to return to their trees unless they wanted to die. The shapeshifter just had to put up with them until that moment came. That tasty thought seemed to help calm the monster's troubled mind, so it decided to keep focusing on it.
So, do you think you can do it, Decanus?
Oh, right. This guy wants me to play Dryad Tamer for a few days.
The Legate spent the last few minutes laying out plans for the upcoming siege. Boxy only half listened since it gave them the idea in the first place. It just really didn't want to be responsible for its execution since the shapeshifter had no idea whether this Operation Honey Trap thing would succeed. Its only real concern during its sales pitch had been to make it sound plausible enough to convince this bunch to hand over a criminal amount of money. Truly, the only culprit behind Boxy's current predicament was its past self. On the bright side, the monster had a newfound understanding of a certain idiom regarding reaping and sowing.
I believe so, sir.
Kira nodded after a moment of consideration.
Oh?
Aiden raised an eyebrow.
You sound remarkably confident.
It really isn't that complicated. It shouldn't be too hard to tell the troops apart since the army colors are so different.
The Empire's forces liked to tout uniforms, cloaks, and tabards that were royal blue with golden embroidery, which would be worn over black armor. The Republic's heraldry, on the other hand, was predominantly gray and silver with a black trim.
Yes, that much is a given. But how do you plan to motivate them?
Permission to speak freely, sir.
Granted.
Well, listening to these darlings go on and on made it sound like they think of themselves as trees first and people second. They act like children, too. So, if we want to get on their good side, we just need to give them stuff that trees would like. Oh, and I guess they're probably closer to monsters than people, but that just means they'll respond to bribes and bait better than words or promises.
Hmm. Very observant, Decanus. Surprisingly sound judgment, noted the Legate with a grand nod.
Fayhorn failed to withhold a smug smile upon witnessing a high-ranking officer approve of his former student, despite her rambling and scatterbrained explanation.
So then, what would we offer to their trees? Maybe some pest control or medical aid is in order?
Aiden cupped his chin as he thought back on their words earlier.
One of them mentioned something about itching. Perhaps she's suffering from some sort of infestation or infection we could assist with.
Oh, I actually already thought of something way better,
Kira proudly declared.
Sir.
And what would that be, Decanus?
Fertilizer, sir. Enough to satisfy all five of these kids' trees.
Yes, that was my first thought as well. There's just one problem.
Aiden leaned forward on his elbows.
Where do you propose we find that much manure on such short notice, Decanus?
It's already on its way, sir.
What's that supposed to mean?
The cat girl's face shifted slightly. Her mouth was still curled up in an innocent smile, but her eyes practically oozed with hatred as she gave voice to her darker thoughts.
We have 30,000 bags of first-grade fertilizer walking towards us at this very moment. Do we not?
It was the kind of monstrous logic only a deeply disturbed individual could think up. Part 6. A heavy silence hung over the meeting room. Fayhorn, Underwood, Aiden, Dranor, and Vera looked at the empty seat in front of them with bitter faces. All of them were either unable or unwilling to say anything. A few minutes passed like this since the person responsible for this heavy mood had left the room. With a smile and a spring in her step, no less.
30,000 bags of fertilizer.
As per usual, the first one to break the silence was Aiden, legate of the Third Legion. He spoke in a quiet tone that was unbefitting of him as he slumped back in his chair. Having heard those chilling words once again injected some life back into his colleagues.
Well, she's technically right, I suppose,
Dranor chuckled dryly.
Those eyes, though.
Vera shook her head.
It's like she literally doesn't see the Empire's troops as people anymore. It may be a good attitude for a soldier to have, but as a person...
I fucking hate this war, growled Fayhorn.
You'll have plenty of chances to hate it later, old friend.
Underwood slapped the ranger on the back.
It hasn't even started for real yet.
When did she become like this, Silas? She used to be this bright-eyed girl filled with hope and ambition. Now she's... like that.
It's just the shock of recent events. I bet this all just feels surreal to her right now, which is why she's acting out like this.
You said she had ample reason to hate the Empire, spoke the legate. But even I find that much animosity disturbing. What exactly did she go through, Primus?
As far as I understand from interviewing her close confidants, an Imperial patrol killed her parents. She'd been told it was an accident, but she believes it was both intentional and malicious, and holds a deep grudge towards the enemy's military and authority. And that was before she and her teammates were captured and humiliated by the enemy.
Ah, of course.
The alleged incident had been described fully in one of the recent reports, but with so much going on, it momentarily slipped his mind. Underwood didn't seem to want to discuss the matter further, and Aiden was in total agreement. Kira's mentor couldn't help himself, though.
Did I mention I fucking hate this god's damned war? Your displeasure at our foreign political situation is noted, Fayhorn,
the legate groaned.
Still... I'm not going to pretend I understand her feelings, but I can't fault her for her resentment.
I'm more worried about those dryads myself,
the strategist changed the subject.
Even if the demonstration tomorrow proves they can be used, the effects an actual war will have on them. If they develop a taste for blood, we may have to abandon the fort for good.
Well,
I doubt they'll actually do it for the fertilizer.
The ranger replied.
If dryads were really after stuff like that, the capital would be a graveyard by now.
You said it yourself, though.
Vera chimed in.
They're still technically monsters, even if they carry Nairi's blessing, as the legends say. Doesn't that mean they may see us as the enemy eventually?
I think it will be fine.
so long as we don't agitate or harm them or their trees in any way. They clearly don't bear us any ill will. If that wasn't the case, Imriel's prideful gaffe would have cost her far more dearly than a spanking.
The prefect conceded the point with a firm nod, and the group continued discussing the long-term ramifications of Operation Honeytrap for another half hour. They hadn't even given the final say-so on whether they would attempt it, so it was important to consider all the potential outcomes and risks. Old battlefields near ancient hilt trees were brought up, religion and the goddess Nyri's will were touched upon, and various contingencies were roughly outlined. This came to an abrupt end when the sole comm crystal in the room flashed and vibrated against the wooden table it rested on. The discussion came to an abrupt end as the five elven officers shared a few knowing looks. With a nod from the legate, Underwood reached over, grabbed the item, and accepted the call. The transparent, blue-colored image of a man with a cloth wrapped around his head and a heavy cloak on his broad shoulders appeared out of thin air.
Lord Underwood.
The voice was completely befitting that appearance, which was to say it was deep, ominous, and a bit raspy. Silas furrowed his brows and sighed as he remembered the previously agreed-upon identification code.
"Hear me, my good fellows. Lend me thy ears,"
he started.
"For I have left mine in my other trousers,"
the vigilante finished.
"It is good to hear from you, Mr. Sandman."
This was one of several similarly ludicrous passphrases this masked individual insisted on using. It was a bit rudimentary, but necessary. The other party refused to reveal their face, and Silas needed some other way to confirm that he was talking to the real deal, and not some random guy in a cloak. In reality, the image he was looking at was actually a succubus filling in for her preoccupied master. This ruse was fairly simple, since the comm crystal showed only the bust of the other party holding it, making it painfully easy to obscure things like height or build. A bit of shape-shifting, a spare disguise, and copious amounts of telepathic communication handled the rest.
"Likewise,"
the not-Sandman nodded.
"I trust your compatriots and leaders are with you as per usual?"
"Indeed, they are,"
Silas confirmed. Comm crystals projected only the voice and visage of the one holding them, so Zira could neither see nor hear the rest of Fort Yemen's leadership. They let Underwood handle the talking for the most part, but they had all formally introduced themselves during previous communications by passing the cube from one person to the next. Everyone except for Fayhorn. The others hadn't made the Sandman aware of the High Elf's attendance because he'd be less likely to let down his guard if he knew. Or so Silas theorized.
"I trust you have already tried out my little bauble and confirmed its ability,"
the masked man inquired. Underwood looked towards the legate, as if asking how to answer.
"Do not tell him about the Decanus. Just say we have confirmed its effects,"
was the given order. The intelligence officer nodded and turned his attention back to the Sandman.
"In a manner of speaking, there were some complications, but nothing we can't handle."
"Very good. I trust you will not misuse Nyri's children for your own ends."
"Should we ask him whether letting the youngling dryads fight our war for us is a good idea?"
Thera suggested.
"A good idea,"
Aiden nodded.
"Relay her question, Primus."
"Yes, about that. We are having a quandary whether that would be best for us in the long run,"
Silas told the Sandman.
"How so?"
was the casual response.
"We have serious concerns that forcing so much death upon the immature dryads will turn them into bloodthirsty killers."
The cloaked figure let out a low, dry, almost mocking laugh.
"You should not be so quick to force your point of view onto others, Mr. Underwood."
"Excuse me?"
"Tell me, do you give any mind to the grass and weeds you trample underfoot each day? Do you pay the buzzing flies in your office any more attention than a moment of annoyance? Is the existence of rats in the sewer worth your notice?
Silas frowned, as he had a rather unpleasant thought as to where this was going.
It is the same thing for the Dryads.
The Sandman grinned under his mask.
As living creatures, it is their duty to defend themselves, but they are ultimately apathetic to the struggles of us lesser beings. Before them, we are all but specks of dust, insignificant and fleeting existences that will rapidly fade from their memory, even if noticed.
As per usual, he says some rather depressing things,
Dranor commented.
To think we mere mortals can influence them to any meaningful degree is the height of arrogance.
The cloaked figure concluded his speech.
That is certainly a very enlightening point,
Silas collected himself.
But children tend to be quite impressionable.
Children? What do you mean?
Judging from what we've seen, Fort Yemen's dryads are extremely juvenile. They appear as 10-year-old children, both physically and mentally.
Ah, that is unexpected. I hoped they would be more mature, but it is what it is.
Shall I infer from your tone of voice that you still don't think the war will have a negative impact on them?
It depends on the point of view. Once the authority wears off in a week, they will all return to their slumber. It will be centuries before they wake up on their own, and anything they experience now will most likely be completely forgotten about, as if it were a hazy dream. Whether that's a good or bad thing is something for history to decide.
This was information obtained directly from Ambrosia and passed along to Zira, who now relayed it to the elves. It was as accurate as it could be, though the officers had no way of knowing that.
We appreciate the input,
Underwood said politely.
Speaking of the authority...
I will want it back, of course.
The Sandman cut them off.
Though I suppose if you wanted to keep it for yourself, then I wouldn't be able to stop you.
There will be no need for that. Please be assured that we plan to uphold our end of the bargain. Once we have confirmed the Dryad's effectiveness, we will send you the rest of the payment and the spent item through your chosen courier.
Very good, Lord Underwood.
Are we sure we want to do that?
Asked Vera.
If that thing can let one control Dryads, then the capital will be at his mercy.
Come on, we already discussed this,
Fayhorn complained.
We did?
Okay, maybe not exactly that,
the ranger elaborated.
But we concluded that the authority's function is like a really loud knock on the door. Yes, it grabs the Dryad's attention, but there's no compulsion involved. Sure, those five seem to be glued to Morgana and hang off her every word, but that's because they're youngsters that don't know any better. I can't imagine any one man can convince the old hags of the capital to turn on us after millennia of coexistence.
The man imagined Azurvale's original 12 to be akin to the grumpy old ladies that sat on benches in parks and quietly judged everyone who walked past. To his credit, it was a surprisingly apt comparison, apart from the fact that said old ladies looked a lot more fertile than one might expect from beings that ancient.
Just so we're clear on this, expect to see me at the siege.
The Sandman's words caused everyone's attention to snap back to the glowing blue cube in Underwood's hands.
Will we get another bill for your services, then?
Silas asked with a wry smile.
No. This one's on the house.
Is it now? How come?
I'm just, shall we say, protecting my investment,
he responded cryptically.
I see. Whatever your reasons, do make sure you wear our army's colors when the time comes. Would hate for our men to mistake you for an enemy combatant.
Who knows? I just might become one. If the price is right.
The elf made a bitter face, as he was harshly reminded that the Sandman's loyalties lay not with the Ishigar Republic or its people, but its coin. The masked man chuckled humorlessly.
Very well, Mr. Underwood. If you so wish it, then my minions and I shall fly your army's silver flag on the field. Expect to hear from me again. Same time tomorrow.
Understood.
The communication cut off abruptly, and Silas let out a subdued sigh of relief. These conversations with Mr. Sandman were far more stressful than he let on.
What minions is he talking about?
Fayhorn asked.
Demons, most likely, Silas responded. We've already determined him to be a warlock, and that he has at least two of them in his service, possibly three. I'm more worried about what he meant by that protecting his investment statement,
Draenor interjected.
He's probably hoping we'll keep him around as an assassin or mercenary after the siege, possibly even after the war.
Underwood's guess seemed reasonable. But in truth, that line was just a cheap excuse for Boxy to join in the mayhem and collect its share of XP and human flesh.
We'll see how the winter season finds us, the legate decreed. As for the matter of the dryads, I will withhold my final decision until I see what our decanus has for us tomorrow.
The meeting adjourned, and Underwood, Vera, and Fayhorn left the room in an orderly and quiet fashion. The legate and his strategist wanted to discuss things in private, so they stayed behind. The sun was still up, so the High Elf Ranger went out to the courtyard to mull things over while the others returned to their duties. And there, he saw a bizarre scene. Kira was giving one of the juvenile dryads a ride on her shoulders, while the rest of them crowded around her. The adorable scene of them arguing who was next on Mummy's Branches did wonders to heal his troubled heart. Unlike before, the beastkin didn't seem troubled or anxious, but was genuinely laughing and having fun as they walked in full view of the entire fort. Keeping those kids' existence a secret at this point was both impossible and unwise, so Underwood and Aiden had both given Kira permission to show them around the fort and introduce them to the troops. As expected, they drew an incredible amount of attention from adventurers and soldiers alike. A few of the hardliners scoffed at the undisciplined display, while others stared in blank amazement at the appearance of the legendary Hilt Tree Guardians. Most of them were like Fayhorn and simply enjoyed watching the uplifting sight without giving it too much thought. Even if they were technically monsters, the appearance of happy, giggling children could melt even the most jaded of hearts.
Even if they're monsters, huh?
Fayhorn's thoughts drifted back to a discussion he and Silas had held earlier regarding the Sandman's identity. Though the officer argued otherwise, the veteran adventurer's intuition told him there was a literal monster behind that mask. However, though the vigilante certainly had the selfishness and general disregard for sentient life one expected from a non-enlightened creature, his behavior was far too atypical. Generally speaking, one could categorize monsters as either feral or intelligent. The former would not bother with conversation and would pursue their wants and needs with brute force and extreme aggression. These creatures were certainly dangerous, but it was the smart ones that were the real issue in Fayhorn's professional opinion. A rampaging cyclops could attack a village and kill dozens of people before it was put down, but a devious and cunning creature could claim hundreds or even thousands of victims over a long period of time. The intelligent ones knew just how much of a potential threat they were to society, and how said society would respond to that threat should it become known. The last thing these monsters wanted was to find themselves hunted down by a bunch of experienced adventurers armed to the teeth. Intelligent creatures, therefore, actively avoided drawing the attention of enlightened communities at large, especially those they recognized as wielding power and authority. Yet, this Sandman directly approached and actively made deals with the military. A monster doing that sort of thing only happened in terrible novels. Fayhorn couldn't confidently state that the vigilante was not an enlightened individual, especially since his objective did legitimately seem to be acquiring wealth. Then there was the fact that, according to Silas, the Sandman had requested that future payments be delivered as equal numbers of knight, duke and king pieces, coins worth 5, 20, and 50 GP, respectively. The only reason someone would make that sort of demand was if they planned to spend the money inconspicuously. Well, either that or the vigilante was just hoarding wealth for wealth's sake. Except that the only monsters that did that were dragons, and the Sandman most certainly wasn't one of them. Size and shape aside, dragons did not make deals. They demanded tribute. They were the zenith of the food pyramid, the undisputed kings and queens of the monster world. Their power was so vast that an adventurer would need a level at least 10 times higher than the dragon's before he could even hope to challenge it. And that was only if it was a juvenile one. Adult dragons took entire squads of ranker adventurers to defeat, but at least they could be stopped. Elder dragons, which could go up to level 75 of their monster job, were unfathomable existences that could literally topple nations by themselves if given enough reason. Thankfully, there existed only 4 of those beasts in the known world, and none were anywhere near this part of the world. One of them lorded over a stretch of land that once belonged to the dwarven-ruled Horkensaft Kingdom to the east, a highly volcanic region known as Hell. Another ruled over vast swathes of the Pearly Dunes Desert, the Beastkin's homeland far to the southeast on the literal other end of the continent. The last two weren't even on Attica. One of them resided at the bottom of the Shimmering Ocean, while the last dwelled somewhere in the sprawling jungles of Velos, a landmass far to the south. The fact that the Republic didn't have to deal with those living calamities had always been something Fayhorn was quietly thankful for.
Mr. Fayhorn, sir!
Hearing Kira call his name snapped the old ranger out of his thoughts. The redhead ran over to where he was idly leaning up against a wall while he wasn't paying attention. It was almost impressive he failed to notice Kira approach, considering one of the dryads rode her shoulders while the other 4 followed behind, bickering. The topic of their current argument seemed to focus on which one of them was the tallest, but Fayhorn tried not to pay them too much mind.
"What is it, Morgana?"
he asked in his usual cut-and-dry tone.
"I have some good news. Lily told me something really good."
Her eyes pointed up at the dryad who happily played with the redhead's feline ears while murmuring something along the lines of, "So fuzzy."
"Did she now?"
Her mentor raised an eyebrow.
"Mm-hmm. Hey, Lily, remember what you said earlier?" "Hmm? About what, Mummy?" "You know, about people like Mr. Fayhorn here."
The dryad's emerald eyes met with the ranger's. This was the first time he saw any of them acknowledge anyone's existence besides Kira's and their own. The experience was quite jarring, though mostly because he felt as if the kid was staring straight into his soul. It lasted only for a moment, as she immediately turned her attention back towards the cat girl's ears.
"What about them? You don't want to hurt them, right?" "Of course not. If I'm mean towards them, then Grandma Nairi would be sad,"
Lily casually stated.
"Making Grandma sad would be bad,"
the other 4 echoed in unison.
"There you have it, Mr. Fayhorn,"
Kira smiled.
"That's good news, isn't it?"
Yes, it is. Good news might actually be an understatement.
It would appear these dryads felt the influence of the goddess of fertility and were forbidden from harming the enlightened. The myths about them stated something along those lines, but hearing it from the girl herself was immensely reassuring.
"Hey, Terenia!"
Kira raised her voice.
"Enough arguing about the evening sunlight, okay?"
"But she gets almost all of it!"
one of them complained while pointing at the other.
"You get most of the morning sunlight in return, though, don't you?"
the redhead pointed out.
"Yes."
"Then you should be more tolerant of your sister."
"Yes, Mummy."
"And Castelia, don't let this go to your head."
"Huh?"
The dryad that Terenia had been bickering with put on a shocked expression.
"Mr. Sun shines down on all of us. His light and warmth are things you should share and not selfishly hog to yourselves."
"Yes, Mummy."
The 2 answered in unison with sullen faces. Kira's serious business face softened into the usual smile, and she patted their heads lightly, which they enjoyed quite a bit.
"Ah, Mr. Fayhorn, will His Excellency the Legate be needing me again today?"
Not that I'm aware of. Why do you ask?
The catgirl gently stroked the heads of one of the dryads to her left, the one that scratched her shoulder the entire time.
Birches here seems to have a termite nest in her upper branches, and I want to take my men to clear it out while we have the chance.
She was officially a decanus, which meant she already had her own 10-man squad assigned to her.
Ah, then that should be all right. Though I gotta say, I'm surprised you can tell them apart.
Personalities and behavioral quirks aside, the quintuplets looked completely identical. Only the bushels of hair on their heads showed any deviation as they swayed gently in the wind. But that was not nearly enough to differentiate between them.
It's really not that difficult once you figure out they always stand on the same side,
the redhead cheerfully revealed.
What do you mean?
The catgirl pointed towards one of the massive trees on her right, one of the cornerstones of Fort Yemen's fortifications.
See, that's Tyrrhenia.
She then pointed to the tree that was immediately to the west of it.
And that's Castilia. The one directly behind me is Lily. That one over there is Birchus. And that last one over there is Pinea.
Oh, I see, Fayhorn exclaimed in realization.
The way the hilt trees were positioned around the fort and the formation the children made around their mother lined up perfectly.